Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Cooking issues will be starting shortly. Please stay tuned.
Hi there, I'm Greg from Kapow. Visit us at kapow.com to check out our unique collection of everyday reusable products designed to help you do more with less. C-U-P-P-O-W.com.
Hey, I'm Jimmy Carboni from Beer Sessions Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live on the Heritage Radio Network from Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick, Brooklyn. How you doing, folks? Call in your questions to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. Joined in the studio, as usual, with Nastasia the Hammer Lopez. How you doing, Stas?
Good.
Yeah, everything good? And, of course, in the booth, we got Jackie Molecules.
Jack. Hello.
Now, Jack.
Molecules.
Now, Jack, it's going to be sad times for Cooking Issues because, good news for you, you're going to go out on tour pretty soon, right?
I am, yeah. There's a lot on the horizon for me right now.
But if you're on tour, that means that you're not going to be in the booth.
Well, you know, there'll be the ghost of Jackie Molecules. I do hope to kind of call in from some of these cities. I'll be in London. I'll be in the east of England, some weird little town, Ipswich, I think. Then I'll be in Paris and I think Barcelona and Iceland.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I want to go to Iceland.
Me too. Yeah, I'm excited about that one the most. We're playing shows in like the weirdest places in Iceland, so that'll be fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, if the listeners want to check out the music, it's Odetta Hartman 222, which I think I've shamelessly plugged on the show before, but that's the record that I produced. I play with her live, and we're hitting the road.
So what's up with the 222? What's the meaning of the 222?
Well, let's see. Her birthday is the 22nd. Her number is 2. That's just where it starts. And then we had this thing where we would always send each other screenshots when it was 2:22 p.m. on the phone, back and forth, just as a kind of like whatever thing. And then it turns out she researched the number 222, and it's some weird like numerology. It's like an angel number of it. The meaning behind it is like a divine collaboration kind of thing or something. So I don't know. There are all these coincidences with the twos. So we just went. And then the record itself is 22 minutes and 22 seconds long. By chance.
That first of all, You're lying.
Well, okay. The final mixdown, listen, the final mixdown was like 21 minutes and 40 seconds, and I was like, I'll be damned if this isn't 22:22. It was close enough, you know?
Yeah, so
it was,
that is not by chance.
Yeah, shave it. It's close enough by chance.
Right, thanks. Yeah.
Exactly. So how many twos are in the album, though? Only three. What have you got a fourth two there?
Yeah, I know. It's just kind of a hanging two.
Hanging two. All right. Well, anyway.
My last show in the studio will be the week of the 24th. So I don't know. What day would that be? The 19th or something? June 19th?
That'll be a sad day.
Yeah.
That'll be a sad day.
We'll pop champagne.
Me's.
For Stas mostly, not for me.
Me's in the back, provided by Peter Kim, the director of the Museum of Food and Drink, coming off of his... I'm sure you went on some huge bender because you just finished the spring benefit.
Yeah. Well, actually, no. I the next morning, Alice Waters came and visited the museum, and then I had to do this shoot for CBS Sunday Morning on the Chinese takeout box.
Didn't liquor yourself up for the Alice Waters meeting? No?
I think that was a yes.
Yeah, that was a yes. That was a secret yes. Yeah,
that's right.
He was actually, he wasn't using liquor, he was chewing cot. Is cot actually illegal here in the
U.S.? It is highly illegal, so I know nothing of it.
Yeah, your old lawyer day is coming back.
It is highly illegal, Dave.
All right, so we got some interesting stuff we're going to do here on the program today. We're going to call into Harold McGee.
He's on the line.
Oh, he's on the line?
Patiently waiting.
All right, well, and Daniel Gritzer is going to come in later to help answer someone else's question on nixtamalization. But Harold, how you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks. How about you guys?
Oh, good, good. Harold was the 2016 recipient of, what was the exact?
A MOFED honoree, yeah. 2016 honoree.
Yeah. You might know him as the person who knows everything about the science of deliciousness, or at least has taught us everything about the science of deliciousness. If you haven't already purchased On Food and Cooking, The Keys to Good Cooking, and gone on Bookfinder, and also purchased The Curious Cook off of someone else's used bookstore, then do that now. Stop listening to us and go buy that right now. Are you ever going to republish that on your website, The Curious Cook? I know you have excerpts out there.
Yeah, I should really do something about that, shouldn't I?
Yeah, because it's not like republishing the old information from On Food and Cooking in the first edition, which I know you're like, I'd have to go revisit it. This is more about just experiments. You could write literally like a 2-paragraph addendum being like, this is no longer 100% what I think, but this is how I went through the experiment at that time. It'd still be useful for people, no?
Yeah, that's true.
just my personal feelings. All right, so I met someone at Booker and Dax recently, and she had said that her mom had just had a virus and had knocked out her olfaction. And the doctors, you know, said that, you know, it might come back 100%, it might come back partially, it might take weeks, it might take months. And I told her that I know someone – you, Harold, who had a similar problem, and so I just thought I'd have you on to talk about kind of what that was like, especially for someone who, you know, food is such a big part of their life, and kind of how you made it through it, and kind of whether there was any sort of thing you could do to help yourself out while it was going on.
Yeah, it was not fun. And I think you might remember it because it was a couple of years ago when we had just finished lecturing at Harvard, and I was coming down to New York City to participate in a country ham tasting, mm-hmm. where the whole point is to taste and notice qualities. And like a week or 10 days before I came out to Harvard, I just woke up one morning, made a cup of coffee, and realized I couldn't taste my coffee, or I couldn't smell it. And that was scary because I'm in the middle of writing a book about smell. So I have a friend who was at the time the director of the Monell Chemical Senses Center in Philadelphia, you know, center that specializes in taste and smell. And I wrote him immediately and said, what do I do about this? And he basically said, it's a very common problem that lots and lots of people over the course of their lifetime do lose their sense of smell for a period of time, that it's happened to him, and that there's really nothing that specialists in the field can do to help or to comfort you. You know, there's just no predicting when it's going to come back and how. So he said, just relax and try to enjoy the other qualities of foods. And so I did that. And what I found, I did find that my my interest in eating really declined. You know, it's smell is such a big part of it that I would just not see the point of working really hard to make something nice for dinner anymore. So what I did end up doing, though, is just noticing that when you can't smell food, then the other qualities become that much more important. So I found that if a food was undersalted, or if the meat was kind of, you know, tough and dry and not very interesting, that I just it made that particular dish really unappealing, and I just didn't want to eat any more of it. So my feeling is that you know, investing in the idea that it's going to come back at some point, and you have to keep yourself healthy in the meantime and eat reasonably, then what you do, if you're cooking for yourself or if you're cooking for someone else who has this problem, is just to make the food as appealing in all its other aspects as possible. And so that means the seasoning. It means I found myself using lemon juice and lime juice a lot more than I would have in the past. I liked crunchy things and really smooth, silky things, but stuff that kind of dried out my mouth, you know, just that didn't do it for me anymore.
So tannins, you like laid off tannins and a lot of tannic stuff?
Yeah. One thing I remember doing that sounds a little, well, it is kind of peculiar, but, you know, I live in California. There's a lot of citrus around all the time. And so I was trying to, you know, eat my oranges, get my vitamins. And I noticed one day when I peeled my orange and then it took me a few hours to get around to eating it, I got distracted by something else. You know how the skin around each segment dries out? And it turns out if it dries out enough, instead of being chewy, which was not something that I was interested in without any sense of smell, it becomes really crisp. And then you get this kind of burst of flavor when you bite into it that made eating oranges, something as simple as eating oranges, much more interesting to me.
And this was on like a navel or like a Satsuma, like a more of a clementine kind of a situation?
Actually, it was to begin, I first found it in the smaller ones, in tangerines, clementines, things like that. But it also works for navels. And then I discovered that M.F.K. Fisher actually wrote about this, you know, decades and decades ago. She was living in France. She wasn't getting, she didn't have the money to eat spectacularly well, but she found that if she left peeled a mandarin orange, left it on her radiator until it dried out, she got that wonderful release of flavor. Anyway, so the little things like that I found could make a really big difference. And then I also am a believer in the idea that, you know, the more effort you make, the more you kind of make your olfactory system think that its expectations are high for it, that it'll come back faster. So I would just really concentrate on trying to smell things, even when I wasn't really getting anything. And I don't know if that makes a difference or not, but at least you have the feeling that you're, again, making an effort, exercising the system, even if it's not responding the way you want it to yet.
Now, so people know, at the beginning, this wasn't like, oh, I have a stuffy nose. This is like nose clear, knocked out, though, right? Like knockout.
Yeah. No, that was the scary thing, is that I had no other symptoms. If I'd had a head cold, then sure, it kind of makes sense that my sense of smell is a little impaired. But I had had no other issues whatsoever. Just realized one day I was drinking my coffee and I wasn't tasting coffee.
Was there any moment during this time when you found anything delicious?
Well, yeah, in a kind of partial way. I mean, potato chips, because they're salt, and actually potato chips, sea salt and vinegar potato chips, because that was really hammering my taste buds, and the crispy, crunchy piece of it was really wonderful, too. That was sort of my go-to, just to get calories, because I really wasn't interested in eating.
Did you do any of the texture only kind of famous dishes like Bird's Nest or any of that stuff?
No. I should have done that. Mm-hmm.
Hopefully,
that.
You will not have the chance to do it again. And now, the other thing is, did it come back slowly or? My memory serves it came back somewhat gradually over the course of like a week or something, right?
Or even longer than that. I mean, it was several months before it came back. And then one day, as I say, I would try to make an effort to smell things. I would just kind of snort, trying to get the air rushing through my nasal passages harder. And one day I just noticed that there seemed to be a little bit of a hint of flavor. I think it was, again, in my morning cup of coffee. And it would then just go away, and I wouldn't get anything at all, and I was thinking, well, maybe I hallucinated it, and over the course of several weeks, it slowly came back to the point where I didn't have to snort. I would actually get it just by normal breathing.
Huh. Mm, scary. So, do you want to... I actually have a question that you probably have some answers to. You want to stay on with me, or do you have to scoot off? It's up to you.
I could stay on for another 10, 15 minutes or so.
All righty. Here we go. I got a question in on Nastasia's favorite. And she didn't actually punk you with this, Peter, but Peter also likes this.
I'm going to jump in. We actually got a caller for you and Harold.
All right. So. We'll do that. We'll take the caller first.
Cool.
All right. Caller, you are on the air.
How's it going? How's it going, Dave?
Good.
I was wondering if there's any way to make cream unchurnable.
Unchurnable? Or unturnable?
Yeah, not turn into butter at all.
Oh. Harold, do you know of anything?
Unchurnable. Well, starting with homogenized cream helps. That makes it a lot harder, but I think it would still, if you went at it hard enough, it would still churn.
I mean, you could probably stabilize the ever-loving crap out of it, right? I mean... If you were to dope it with, it's got what? It's 70% water, 66, 60, 65, six, somewhere between 60 and 70% water in the cream that you have. So you could probably boil that a little bit to extract out some of the water, take pure water, hydrate some sort of, some sort of thickener, and maybe that would help protect it in the way that... In the way that starch prevents yolk from curdling when you cook it. I don't know, Harold. Do you think anything like that could help, like sterically hinder the fat agglomerating, or no?
Yeah, no. I think the fat globules themselves are pretty stable to heat. So putting enough interfering material in there to get in the way of the globules touching each other. That would probably be it.
Right. I mean, you could probably turn the entire thing into a fluid gel, right? If you wanted to, and then if you did that, I wonder whether or not. I wonder whether or not you could prevent it from... the texture would be weird. It wouldn't be cream, but you might be able to stop it from having the ability because the individual... I think that the particles that you would have... You know how big the fat globules are, like, Harold? Like roughly in micrometers? I have no... micrometer? I have no idea.
I think it's on the order of 10, unhomogenized.
Right. So if you homogenize it smaller?
Yeah.
Okay, so the limits of your tongue are roughly 20, right? Which means that if your fluid gel particles are somewhere between the order of 10 and 20, right? You should be able to lock a number of fat globules inside of the particles in the fluid gel and maybe prevent them from agglomerating, because they'll just be kind of trapped up in something that stays as a coherent unit. That's just a, this is a complete guess right out of my behind. I have no idea, but it's something to try. You know, what do you think, Harold? Is this any of this reasonable or no?
Yeah. No, that sounds reasonable. Sounds like a good experiment.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, appreciate it. It's going in a frosty factory, so I don't know if the temperature or the constant movement is going to affect those the fluidity of the fat in it at all. And that was my only concern.
Oh, if it's in a fat, I'm sure you could just use some sort of steric inhibition or something, stabilizer. But yeah, you'd have to worry about. You'd have to worry about whether it's still going to flow fluidly or not. The fluid gel will flow fluidly if it's a low enough fluid gel, but I think the lower the concentration on the fluid gel, the more it's a regular liquid with some particles in it that are stabilizing it versus particles with some liquid around them, you know? But again, this is you're stretching way back on my memory banks for how to dork with things.
Yeah, well, I appreciate the help, guys.
All right, let us know, tweet on in, let us know what happens. Ooh, look, and we're joined. We have, this is like a full house here. We got Daniel Gritzer in, because I had a question later. So, Harold, Daniel, howdy, Daniel. Have a seat. This is a question.
Congratulations, Dan.
Thank you.
Oh, what happened? What happened?
You got married.
Oh, you got married? Oh, yeah. How's that? How do you like being married? I like it.
It's good.
Yeah? It's all good.
It's all good.
All right.
You know what else, Dave?
What?
It's episode 250 today.
Yeah? Nice.
Isn't that nice?
Nice even number.
Serendipity here.
Yeah. Nice.
It's a good way to celebrate 250.
It is.
Gritzer and McGrath, man, McGee. That's good.
Yeah. Peter Kim.
Oh, right. And Peter Kim, yeah.
This guy over here.
So, speaking of The Curious Cook and the fact that you should republish it, Harold, we have a question on, and it's written this way, Jerusalem Fartichokes. Jerusalem Fartichokes. I will read the question. This is from David in Ottawa. We've been making Confit J-Chokes at the rest. I like J-Chokes.
Yeah, it's a good name.
I like that. Good rapper name.
It's a great rap name or song. Yeah, J-Chokes. Nastasia, of course. Listeners will remember that Nastasia once gastrointestinally poisoned her friends by feeding them quarts of mildly cooked Jerusalem artichokes in like a salad format at a picnic thing. Literally, she knew.
With no bathroom around anywhere.
Literally, she knew that this was like, you know, fermentation, like, you know, extravaganza going to happen in their guts in the, you know, within the next couple of hours. The reason she knew is because she had done it to herself.
She's anyway, smiling right now.
Yeah, she, just so you know what I deal with, people. Anyway. Basically, we just poached the J-Chokes in clarified butter. When we cooked them, a sticky white scum floats to the surface. That's my next band, Sticky White Scum. Mm. As the line cooks are wont to do, we ate some. It's sticky, sweet, sticky, and delicious. Here's the question. Do you think this scum could just be purified? These are in quotes, Harold. Small chain fructosans and starch-like inulin that McGee describes politely as causing abdominal discomfort. When we ate it, there was no noticeable effect. But also, we're the kinds of people who eat the scum raft from the top of a pot of poaching J-chokes. So perhaps we don't make the best control group. Any thoughts? I guess I could munch down on a full glob of this stuff and see what happens, but I'd rather have an educated guess before risking dinner service ruinations. Regards, David in Ottawa. Okay, well, it's interesting that they're poaching it in butter. I know, you know, inulin is really soluble in water, and that's why, you know, you say boil them in a big pot of water after you let them age for a while. But you guys got any thought? You got any thoughts on this, Harold, Mr. Inulin Man?
Well, I mean, the scum rising to the top—that sounds to me like it's going to be probably as rich in stuff other than inulin. I mean, proteins and you know, surface active materials. So, you know, my sense is it's not going to be especially enriched in stuff that's going to cause trouble.
I mean, well, yeah, except for Jerusalem artichokes themselves. I looked it up because I had the benefit of knowing that I was going to be asked this question, like, you know, an hour or two ago. But it they're like 20% inulin or something crazy like that, right? They're like,
yeah,
they're high in inulin. And inulin itself forms, or can in certain circumstances, form a gel. I didn't read it carefully. I didn't realize it was in butter. So that's a different that they're doing it in butter, so that the, I mean, obviously the scum flowing to the top is probably water-soluble stuff expelled from the chokes, right? The other thing is like, like everyone can tolerate a certain amount of this garbage, not garbage, you know what I'm saying, in their system, right? It's a,
yeah.
It's a soluble fiber. That's the dealy deal. It's soluble fiber, so you can't digest it. The definition of fiber, I think, basically is that you can't digest it, right? That's really, it doesn't have to be fibrous, doesn't have to be a fiber, as long as it's, oh my God, I just, in my mind, now I'm thinking of the Sandlot, because whenever I say fiber, fiber. For those of you know that, you know Sandlot, Danny?
No, I'm missing the reference.
Forever. You never seen this movie,
no.
Jack? Anyone
yes,
seen this
of
movie?
Of course, forever.
Right.
Yes.
Forever. Anyway, so the point being that it goes into your gut, and then the microbes in your gut, they can digest this stuff just fine. They produce a whole boatload of gas, and there you have it, right? But the more you eat of it, probably the more accustomed you get to it, the less of a big dose that your gut microflora get, and the more you can handle it. Wouldn't you say that's true, Harold?
Yes, that's certainly the fact when it comes to beans. That's been studied in bean flatulence, not to my knowledge with inulin flatulence. The other thing to know about the particular bugs that you're feeding is that it's the bifidobacteria that are especially fond of inulin and fructosans and things like that. And they're, of all the bugs in our gut, apparently the ones that are doing us the most good most of the time. So I actually think that, you know, throwing a few slices of Jerusalem artichoke into your daily diet is probably a really good idea.
Yeah, those are the bacteria that they dope into Jamie Lee Curtis's feminine poop yogurt, right?
I don't know about that, but maybe.
It's Activia, right? Am I wrong about this?
Yeah,
Yeah. I think that's what they do. I think that's what they put in. I don't know why it's only for women. Like, why can't men also benefit from this? Is there some sort of a gender? No, from the bacteria doped yogurt to make you poo. Is there an actual difference between the genders in the what the yogurt does to your body? We have not studied this.
Yeah, this needs to be
looked
at more
closely.
Clearly,
nobody knows. Stassi, do you know anything about this?
No. Nope.
Have you seen the Kirsten Wiig imitation of Jamie Lee Curtis pooping herself on Saturday Night Live?
No.
worth a watch. Okay, so the other thing is that a lot of this is in small amounts. Obviously, this isn't going to do much. It's if you gorge on this stuff and you're not used to it is when you're really going to have the hammer come down on you, right?
Exactly, yeah. Yep. And the rawer, the more likely that is. Yeah.
So Peter Kim was using chicory root, which also is extremely high in inulin, for making tablets for the Museum of Food and Drink. And originally we were worried about the dose level of soluble fiber that these folks would be getting. So Peter graciously ate about 15 times as many pills as the average guest could hope to consume. And what happened to you?
Well, I got myself a stack of magazines, lit some candles, and had myself a nice little inulin feast. No, it was fine, man. It was fine. Yeah, and basically we did some calculations on what typical tolerance levels are for inulin and figured that even if a small child ate 100 of these, they'd probably still be okay. So, and I indeed was all right. So,
yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah, nice. Oh, here's a question I have for anyone that's ever thought about this. So, where else do we deal with inulin a lot? Anyone? First of all, inulin, basically long chain fructose. Okay,
yeah.
Long chain fructose. Let's just get that out of the way. So, agave.
Yeah.
Inulin, agave.
And artichokes, right?
Regular artichokes? I don't know. Chicory root, Jerusalem artichokes, agave. But my point is, has anyone made a distilled spirit with Jerusalem artichokes? Like a super long bake, like you do for agave piñas, and then make them into a liquor. You ever heard of anything like that, Harold? Anyone?
No, that sounds like a great idea.
Right?
I think I know who's going to do it, too.
Well, I don't know. Do you have a, like, they grow in rather northern climes, right? It's not a southern vegetable, isn't it? Like, isn't it, can I grow it here?
Yeah. Sure can.
So, I don't have a ready access to it. Maybe I'll try it this year. I'll try to mash some out and do some distillation. But anyone out there, I'm sure someone in the cooking issues world is it's just a kind of lunatic who has tried it. And so, like, you know, let me know. But I think we could have a new distilled spirit on our hands. What would you call that? J-choke?
J-fartka?
Well, you remember, you got to defart it because you're gonna be cooking the ever-loving snot out of it. Anyways.
I don't know. Sun liquor. Or sun booze.
Why do they call them?
Sunflower.
Oh, they're related to sunflowers?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
It's a native, if I'm remembering correctly, it's a native of one of the few food items that come from North America.
There you go. It's our, you know, it's the north part of North America, because remember, Mexico is North America, people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's the north part of Northern America's native, it's like our agave, only, you know, you don't have to wait so long to harvest it, and... I wonder whether there'll be a lot of big flavor differences between different. I don't know. Someone's done it, and they're going to be like, Dave, the reason no one makes this is it tastes like garbage. It tastes like garbage. That's why. You know what I mean? But we should probably have like a someone who's done a lot of distilling of raw materials do it first, so that we you know get rid of the control of this person just doesn't know what the hell they're doing with distillation. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep.
Anyway, but I think it'd be much more interesting to do it the old school way. Actually, cook it until you get sugar, and then ferment it rather than because you can just hit it with enzymes, and then that's it. You know what I mean? Also, inulin breakdown. I was looking up today, really, really rapid at low pH, right? But the fact of the matter is, you have to get below about pH 4 before the hydrolysis of inulin to fructose is very rapid at normal cooking temperatures. And who wants their Jerusalem artichokes to be, you know, more tart than a tomato?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't sound right to me. Would you want that, Harold? Nope. I mean, like, hey, you could speed it up by adding acid, but on the other hand, now all your Jerusalem artichokes taste like acid. You know what I mean? I don't know.
I usually fry mine in Olestra myself.
Dude, don't be going off against Olestra. Have we had this conversation on the air already? Are you making me redo a conversation we've already had on the air?
Yeah.
Seriously? Jack, do you remember me ever talking about Olestra?
I do.
You do because you work with me in the real life. Have we talked about it on air?
Jack stepped away, but I don't remember.
Yeah, well, we probably have. There's nothing wrong... But there are many things wrong with Olestra, like they bind fat-soluble vitamins, so you have to dope yourself with them because otherwise you poop out all the fat-soluble vitamins. But as long as you're using a solid Olestra, it's not going to run out of your behind without your knowing.
Elliot in the chat room remembers.
That's a relief.
Yeah. I tell you, like again, like briefly, that the reason people didn't like the Olestra potato chips was because they were made with hydrogenated fat. And they tasted greasy. In fact, and I've said this before on air, they had to develop a hot air curtain to blow the outside layer of fat off of the potato chips to reduce the greasiness because you're not supposed to fry potato chips in a hydrogenated fat. Not for health reasons, for taste reasons. It just doesn't taste right. Mm-hmm. For the same reason that you're not supposed to fry a donut in a liquid fat because it just doesn't taste right. It tastes greasy. Do you like a greasy donut, Daniel?
Well, no, I don't. I don't love greasy donuts.
Harold, greasy? You like a greasy donut?
Nope.
No, didn't think so. Hey, actually, I don't know, Harold, whether you've done it. If you have time, we have another question that you might have done some work on. Okay, this is from. Well, I don't have who it's from. I got a bread baking question. In particular, it's about the tangzhong roux that is used to mix into a bread recipe to make fluffy bread. Now, what we're talking about here is like the water roux where you pre-make a roux and then you mix it into the bread. You know about this, Daniel?
I don't bake much, so this is new to me.
It's been getting a lot of it's started out in the I guess the early 2000s, but it's been getting more and more play. You know the Asian style bread that is really fluffy
mm-hmm.
and lasts a long time? Harold, you've been following this or no?
No, I have not.
Yeah, all right. Well, so then I'll just go on. Okay, so just so you know, what the basic premise here is... Well, I'll read the question first. Let me see. While I understand that it produces a fluffier and softer final bread product, could you explain the science of why the roux would have this effect on the bread? In the past, I've played with adding some milk into the bread to make it softer as well. How does this roux affect the bread versus just using milk in a recipe? And preliminary research on the webs shows stuff about super hydration. Thanks for such a good podcast. Nice. And by the way, this is from Don Vo in Berkeley, California. He actually calls you out, Peter. He says hello to Dave Nastasia, not Stas, Nastasia Lopez, Jackie Molecules, and Peter Sandwich Aficionado Kim. So Peter, you get the shout out on this as well. So basically, got the BDX cube, and he thinks it's fantastic. And has made an improved Clover Club for him. Okay, so here's the deal. You take take a portion of water. Typically, it's about 5 to 1, so about 5 parts water, 1 part flour, and it's usually not that large amount of the water. But the water, and you cook it like you're making a roux. However, the traditional, the way that it's written in recipes, originally everyone's like, oh, keep it to exactly 65 degrees Celsius, right? And didn't have a chance to make bread, but I made one that I took to 65 on the dot and one that I boiled just to see the difference. So what happens is you're partially, when you take it to 65, you're partially pasting, partially swelling the starch, but you haven't completely gotten all the starch, swell with water and paste it out yet, right? And so what you're really doing is just adding a boat ton more water to the bread than you could do any other way. The same, because if you had added that much water to it without pre-cooking it, you'd lack structure. The water, by pre-swelling the starch, gives you enough structure to form the bread and allow it to cook properly without it. That's it. That's basically what it's doing. Wouldn't you guys agree, just from the description I've given, that that's what's happening?
Undoubtedly. Yeah. So it's like a super hydrated bread, basically.
Yeah. So you could take something and have the workability of like a 70 or 80% hydration dough, but you could be hydrating it kind of much higher. Now, I don't know what the difference is. I'm passing this. Harold, you can't do it. This is boiled after it's cooled, and this is basically boiled, and this is the same ratio. It's pretty much turned to a gel after it's gone back, so that might be a hindrance to the dough. Mm. And then this here is the 65 degree, and that's still more like pudding or runny.
They are different.
They're very different. And so my feeling is, folks, is that don't bother. What you're doing here is you're just allowing yourself to add more water to the dough. I mean, that's basically what you're doing, and maintaining the same workability. That's what's happening here. There might be some other, like, Fancy Dan stuff that's happening when it's not Fancy Dan or Grits, but, Fancy Dan. As it's coming up, but that's basically what's happening. As for the temperature, I don't think you have to be too anal, because the wheat starch is just going to start swelling and pasting when it hits about 60-65°C. So if you just take it off as soon as it goes super thick. But like as soon as it starts to thicken up on you, you're going to be good, because I really wouldn't worry that much about. And also, if you're going to cool it for a long time, I don't know whether or not you're working on the fact that it's retrograding to get the extra structure, or you're getting what's called starch setback to add extra structure, in which case maybe it would make a difference if you heated it longer or not. These are all interesting subjects, but I'd have to actually bake some bread to figure that out, and I didn't have time to do that this morning.
I'm just as curious about the use of the word roux here. I think of a roux as you cooking flour in a fat, but
yeah,
this is essentially is any roux like a flour slurry that is then cooked, whether it's in a water or a fat.
Not that I know of, Harold. You know of why they use this kind of? Can you any guesses on this terminology? Or
no, I think Daniel is right that a roux is flour cooked in fat.
Yeah,
not in water,
and then added to, and then liquid added to it and then presumably the cooking in fat. Right, is to prevent clumping when you add the liquid. I mean, the only purpose of the fat, right, is to prevent clumping. That's all it's doing, right? Is there any other reason for it other than it allows you to evenly heat the flour up to a higher stage of cooking?
Oh, I bet it makes a difference for the flavor. Even a neutral oil, you're going to get reactions to take place that wouldn't happen if it was just dry heat.
Okay. Fair. Yeah. So different flavor from adding the oil afterwards.
Yeah.
Fair enough. And this also, obviously, you could do this with non-wheat starches and all sorts of other things, as other people have done. It's an interesting thing. So it's worth some experimentation. I don't know, Harold, if you have to go or if you can stay, but we got a question. Daniel wrote a article on nixtamalization for the Sirius Seeds, correct? What's your current title there anyway?
Oh, Culinary Director.
Culinary Director, okay. And you wrote an article on nixtamalization, very kindly actually gave a shout-out to an article I had written.
Because I used it heavily for information.
So for those of you that don't know, nixtamalization is the process by which you cook. You can do it with other grains, actually, but you par cook corn in an alkaline environment. Par cook in an alkaline environment. It dissolves the coat on the outside of the corn, partially dissolves it. You partially then rub that off. It changes the taste. It changes the rheology of it. Originally, it was designed to allow you to be able to grind corn easily by hand on a stone thing called a metate, but it is the reason that cornmeal doesn't taste like a tortilla, and that a tortilla tastes like a tortilla is the process of nixtamalization. It is also the changes that the corn goes through in terms of partial cooking of the starches, going back to what we were talking about with this roux, whatever you want to call it, bread technique, and the change of the outside of the seed coat into some form of weird hydrocolloid, plus the addition of the fat from the germ, because it's a whole corn kind of a situation. All of that together makes masa, which is what makes an awesome tortilla. Normally, it is a pain in the butt to make. Daniel, you posted a recipe where you used a food processor, and what was your secret? I know what it is. I'm just asking you to ask because it's your...
Right. So, I mean, the big challenge for people at home is grinding the corn properly. You can try a food processor, but that comes with its own challenges, mainly that in order to get everything in the food processor to spin sufficiently enough to grind it to a point where you can form tortillas, you have to add too much water to the mix, and then you have a masa that's far too wet and almost bordering on a batter type consistency, actually more like a hummus. Think of like hummus. You can't really make tortillas from that. So then, basically, adding some masa harina back in, which is the store bought convenience product of masa. That what do? They dry it somehow and turn it into a flour.
They have a large production line where they have like continuous, basically nixtamalization. It goes through a soak tank. I think they dry it and grind it. I don't think that they, Harold, do you know? I don't think they wet grind it and then dry it. I think they dry it and then grind it.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
So not maybe sure. Like ground pozole or something like that.
Yeah.
Sort of like dried.
Yeah. But not, right. It hasn't been re-boiled up to the, yes, but yes, yeah. I think that's how they do it. I don't know. I used to know. But, it's been a long time. I mean, as you point out in your article, like, just buying Maseca. It's Maserina. Maseca is, like, the brand name that everyone gets. Quaker also makes one. There's a bunch of people that make them. And it is a large step above buying pre-made tortillas.
Yeah.
Like once you heat a tortilla and let it cool down again and then put it in your fridge, you have lost. You've lost.
Yeah, they're horrible.
They're good for frying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can fry them up.
Yeah,
that's right.
They're good for frying. They're good, fry them, make chilaquiles, do something like this. But like for like actually eating, no freaking bueno, right? Masa harina is, or maseca is is good. It's much better than a pre-made tortilla, which most of the pre-made tortillas that you are getting are first insult is they're made with maseca. And the second one is that they have cooked them like a week ago and added a bunch of stuff so that it can sit basically at room temperature, fundamentally molding in its own like plastic container.
You ever notice that sometimes they smell like ammonia?
Yeah, because they're all doped up with stuff to stop them from going off on you. But that's, all of those smells go away when you fry them. That's why those are the only chips I use for frying. There's no excuse to buy tortilla chips, pre-fried tortilla chips. They're not as good, and they're really freaking expensive.
Right. Unless you need a lot. I could see an argument if you were doing a party and you need to fill a huge chip bowl for your guac with, you know.
But that's when I start frying, is when I do that. Because, like, think about it this way. You're buying a 20-ounce bag of, like, medium-quality tortilla chips is going to run you, like, four-something dollars, I think, at a store, mm-hmm. right? And you could buy one of those, like, well over, like, I forget how much those stacks of tortillas are, but they're over 20, way over 20 ounces, right? Mm-hmm. And they're thicker, better, and they're like a dollar. And it's so fast to fry them. Most of my home frying now, in Connecticut I have my deep fryer, but, you know, at home, I do most of my frying in a wok. Mm-hmm. The reason is oil expansion is a lot less dangerous in a wok because it's constantly increasing its diameter as it goes up. So people, as long as you don't overfill your wok, you have a lot of safety room on oil expansion when you're working. And tortillas are the most forgiving thing on earth to fry because all you're trying to do is expel the water and get them crunchy. So you oil and wok. I think I said this before, too. Take the tortillas out, do the back break, snack, knacks, break them, individually separate them, cut them in six, fry them, done. Like, I could crank out in under 20 minutes. I could have, you know, big shopping bag, 30, you know, but like shopping bags full of tortilla chips. It's way really like it's one of the few things at home that I would recommend. Frying at home is much easier than doing any other way. But anyway, the point is that someone asked me, should I try this recipe that you wrote? And my answer is yes. It's like, is it worth making your own nixtamal? The nixtamal part's not hard. It's the grinding that's a pain in the butt.
Definitely. I mean, maybe the hardest part, aside from the grinding issue, is just getting the corn.
Oh, yeah, buying the corn. You can't – it's not easy. It's harder even to grind. You can literally try it at home with popcorn. It's not as good, but it is doable.
It's doable?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
It's harder even to grind, and the endosperm to skin ratio is not ideal. But to try it once – you can. I've done it. You said you can get the corn now on Amazon, no?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You totally can. It's just like a 25-pound bag. It's a lot of corn. But you know, I think if you look around there are sources, especially I think even at farmers markets now, where you have these people selling, you know, their fancy little bags of grain. You might be able to find it or. Yeah, online sources, or I don't know, go in on it with a friend and divvy up a large bag. I mean, the other thing is it keeps forever as long as you keep it in good condition. So
you're gonna make me say it forever.
I have to see this.
Yeah. But anyway, the hard part is really grinding. If you try to grind, you just can't grind at the right texture in a food processor. Even like, you know, as the motor's about to burn out, you can't do it. It's just like a nightmare. So I think it's entirely legitimate. To do your nixtamalization and then over wet grind it and dope it back with like masa. So like how much masa are you adding back typically?
It really depends how much water you add to the food processor, and I was eyeballing it every time because it just, I don't know, didn't seem like it needed to be so precise. And different, even if I got that precise, someone else has different corn, it's going to have different requirements.
Yeah.
So it depends, but I would say, I'm guessing, maybe you end up, it's ballpark a quarter to a third masa harina, yeah. And the rest is your freshly nixtamalized masa. And you really do get that fresh nixtamal flavor, even with the addition of the masa harina to soak up that excess moisture.
All right, so we're about to get kicked off here, but let me just say a couple things on the way out. Thank you, Harold, for coming on the show. Thank you, Daniel and Peter. I didn't know Peter was going to be on. You get a limited edition Cooking Issues blue tape key ring there, Daniel.
And, this is awesome.
Hashtag always label. You can fill that up. That's feet of blue tape. And then when you're done with it, you pull this quick pin out, and this fits.
And it blows up.
This fits on the hex drive of like a drill bit, like a Phillips head thing, and then you can refill it with tape, and you're good to go again. So thanks for coming on, talking about Nixta Mall and many things.
Thanks
Harold.
For having me.
Thanks, Peter. A couple tips on the masa. Masa is a whole grain, so there is fat in it. So store it like it might go rancid. In other words, don't keep it forever after you've opened it. Have you ever had that problem? Anyone? Like if you have it for years open, it's going to take a musty kind of rancid note to it.
You mean the flour?
The masa harina. Like I wouldn't open it and then leave it on your shelf for the rest of time.
That's a good tip. I don't know that I've ever.
This is a guess. I've smelled some old stuff and it started smelling cardboardy to me, and then I pitched it and got new. Also, don't be too quick to add the water in the food processor. Let it grind and add in small increments, because a little bit of water goes a long way. You agree with me on that?
Yeah, sure, for sure.
All right, thanks everyone. Coming back next week with Cooking Issues.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.